It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a big shout out to our super producer, Max Encyclopedia Brown-Williams.
Shamalamadingdong.
I am here.
Yes, you are. I am Ben Bullen, joined, as always, with the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Noel Brown, returning from adventures on distant shores.
That didn't quite make... Well, you know what I did do? I got a lovely tour around foggy, foggy Malibu. I saw Cher's house. Mm-hmm. It was pretty cool, if shrouded in fog. And I ate fish and chips at a really cool old divey biker hangout called Neptune's Net.
I love a good fish and chips.
It's close to the shore as I got, though. But it was a nice time. I got to go to the Magic Castle of an evening, which I'd been once before during the daytime, and which is kid-friendly. And it was a hoot. I tipped the player piano and had it play Gangster's Paradise. Irma, the famous... well, it's not a player piano. Irma's a ghost. I was actually scolded for calling it a player piano because it is, in fact, a ghost. Irma is a ghost. That was neat. She'll play any song you want for the right price. I actually tipped $20 and then got a second request a little later, which was Be My Baby by the Ronettes. It was a good time.
Classic follow-up to Gangster's Paradise.
I
was having a lot of weird word adventures. There's a natural Ooh. Segue here. Yeah, we ran into it. Haunted, I was writing the Worcestershire research, and eventually the term lost all meaning. Semantic satiation mm-hmm. is when you just say a word repeatedly, no matter what it is. After a certain threshold, it just becomes like a meaningless jumble of sounds in your mouth.
Oh, but you know what one way to get over that is? Pronounce it differently every time.
Oh, that's cool. That's a good idea.
I mean, that's kind of what we did. I think that's why maybe we said it so many times throughout the course of that episode, right?
It's funny. Because, you know, we all cook a lot. And so after we recorded that, I went, I was prepping to make some dinner stuff. And I had to add the Worcestershire. And I thought, how crazy, man. The English language. This is something we've all accepted. And that's where we go to today's episode. Noel, there's something you, Max, and I have been talking about quite often off air and a little bit on air. One of our favorite sources to cite is the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. Alas, not the hard copies, because it's 2024 and those have unfortunately become a relic of the past. And now everything's online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are fascinating stories about this. This is a little bit of a meta exploration. As a research associate, Max said, we're studying the history of history books and reference works because the encyclopedia wasn't always around. We can start at the beginning. One of the best sources on the Encyclopedia Britannica is, wait for it, can you guess?
Is it the Encyclopedia Britannica?
Nailed it. Nailed it.
Hey.
So, yeah, absolutely. It's if we look at the people writing for Encyclopedia Britannica on their self-same article, we see three authors, Michael Levy, Donald E. Stewart, and Christopher Hardy Wise Kent, point oof. Out. Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
I mean a good positive oof. That's nice. A very powerful name.
They say this is the oldest general language encyclopedia in English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense with a name like that. Originally, it had a bit of a fancier name, spelling at the very least. It was the Encyclopedia, but probably still pronounced Pedia, but it's that cool AE hyphenate kind of letter that squishes them together like in a Tool album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, there's a name for that, isn't it? It's the Latin diphthong.
That's the one.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is it the schwa? I never really know what the schwa is. The diphthong, yeah.
A diphthong is a type of thing. This is just Latin, a gliding vowel.
And hey, a hot tip, pro tip, if you're trying to make some cool death metal text in your phone, if you hold down on a letter, it gives you a drop-down menu yes. of all of the weird extra versions of that letter. So I think you can get this AE one by holding down on the A, I would
yeah,
imagine.
It'll help you also with tildes, with accent marks, and umlauts. If you're
it's a power user trick, and not everybody knows it. Maybe everybody does know it at this point, but when I learned it for my kid, which says something probably, but I thought it was a really cool trick.
I learned it when I was trying to text one of my friends who primarily speak Spanish, and I thought that I had been hacked.
Exactly.
Because I held the E down too long, and I was like, wait a second. It's like when you find out a transformer has another function, you know, the transformer
yeah.
voice.
You weren't seeing the final form at all?
Exactly. And the Encyclopedia Britannica took a while to reach its final form. It was first published in 1768, and it started reaching the masses in Edinburgh, Scotland. And since its founding, it's been a kind of proto-Wikipedia, much more heavily vetted, but they crowdsource, right? Outside experts and then in-house editors.
Yeah, again, I haven't put my hands on a real copy, and we're going to get into the whole history of that and the salesmanship of it all. But were the citations, do you guys remember what the citations read like in the physical Encyclopedia Britannicas?
It would depend on which era. So the earliest stuff, it would generally only reference the editors, but later on it'd be like, this article is written by this person, but then the editors would edit the entire thing.
Got it.
And there was so many different editions of it too that it changed a lot throughout the history.
Yeah, and if you're looking at things like if you're looking for something like the usage case of a linguistic thing, that'll be in there. But you know, we all recognize these articles. It's something like quesadilla, being a sandwich formed from blah, 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 originating from, and they've got the etymology or whatever. We don't know. We haven't read the quesadilla article, but we do know that in general, throughout its different iterations, the Britannica had one thing in common with every version. The entries, I almost said entrees, the entries are fact-checked, edited, and copy-edited by those in-house editors, and that is all to maintain accuracy and, interestingly enough, readability. Because, you know, we've talked with a lot of subject matter experts, and sometimes they can be a bit esoteric.
I was going to say the same thing, Ben. I think the thing that sets Britannica apart from a lot of other kind of deep divey research tomes is its accessibility.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, Noel. We can also go to the National Library of Scotland. Surprise, the National Library likes to brag about the Encyclopedia Britannica. They call it one of the enduring achievements of the Scottish Enlightenment.
So to your point, Ben, it was first issued officially in 1768 with the sort of shorthand of Britannica, which is very nationalistic. Let's just go right out and say it. It's like rural Britannia kind of vibes, you know, which is absolutely cool. They should own it, and they do. It was published by one Colin. Wow.
I love it.
Colin McFarquhar.
Yes.
I think that's right.
I'm pretty certain that's right.
That's McFarquhar. Yeah, I think that's good enough for government work. I also like how it sounds like an obscure curse. You, McFarquhar.
Well, there was that character in the Shrek movies. Remember Lord Farquhar or Farquaad? He was Farquhar. He was the little fellow with the big.
Did you ever see the musical?
It's great because the guy that plays that character just walks around on his knees
the whole time. Dances too. He's a dancer fool.
It's a good effect, yeah. And McFarquhar was a printer, and he also, you know, if you're a printer, you need an engraver. And in this case, Andrew Bell came to his aid. And the first edition was issued in, it was like a weekly, almost like a series.
Yeah.
100 weekly parts. So you didn't come right out of the gate with the massive tome that you once saw before you, at least in terms of what the door-to-door sales.
It was like a really nerdy comic book that later got collected in trade edition.
So it took about 3 years for the full volume, or at least a full volume, to be produced. And when it was completed in 1771, this was three volumes, actually. And we know, of course, it went on to consist of many more than that. Bell, who had a very fine reputation as an engraver for the Scots magazine, produced all 160 copper plate illustrations. Another thing that Britannica is known for, having really cool illustrations early on that went on to become really nice full-color photographs.
Yeah, and also have become artifacts of history in their own right. You know, I love diving into the incredibly specific copper plates, illustrations, the diagrams. The executive editor of Britannica, who Max has a little bit of a crush on, is quoted in a December 30th, 2018 article with CBS News celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Britannica. And this guy, the executive editor, Tem Pappas, he says, Britannica did something unique. It combined long scholarly essays with short definitional entries and practical information. There was also, this is a funny story. In this interview, he says there was also a third person in addition to McFarquhar and Bell, who was responsible for the genesis of this thing, a guy named William Smellie, S-M-E-L-L-I-E.
Sorry.
Yeah, he was sort of their Tyrion. He was very learned and, according to Pappas, also had a, quote, wonderful capacity for drinking.
Oh, and perhaps an accompanying odor.
And perhaps.
If nominative determinism is to be believed.
Right.
A wonderful, he drinks and he knows things and he's a little bit smelly.
Then we have three guys. Two of them have no formal training. The one who does have formal training as a man of letters and an editor is, you know, he likes the sauce. He's a pretty saucy boy. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they were able to actually bring this wildly ambitious work into the real world is pretty fascinating. But they also had, you know, with the benefit of retrospect, we can see that they had some times where they played jazz a little bit. They made some educated guesses.
Well, that's the thing, though. And, you know, and I hear you. And maybe you could easily look at that and be like, ooh, not necessarily the most highly vetted, most, let's just say, illustrious of sources, you know. But I think the fact that it kind of came from curious people is interesting because, I mean, that's sort of our whole thing here on Ridiculous History is we're not what you'd call experts per se, but if anything, we are just professionally curious. And I think that oftentimes leads to some interesting discoveries that maybe might not even be made or questions that might not even be asked by the more, you know, academic of types.
Agreed. I am a great...
The more smelly of types?
Sure. Indeed.
I am a great disciple of an evangelizer for curiosity. It's one of the most amazing parts of the human experience. And so, you know, we forgive the foibles. We have to. You know, if you read the 1768 edition, you see that they've added an extra L to the name of California and gotten some, you know, some facts about that a little bit incorrect. They didn't know if it was a peninsula or an island. Maybe it's easy for people to scoff at that, but I would also ask, where's your encyclopedia? show us your encyclopedia where you wrote one. Oh, wait, did you not? You know what I mean? So these guys also, they're so hungry. They've got such a drive, and curiosity is at the core of their mission. The idea that the world is both understandable and worth understanding. After they release this thing, they take like a little bit of time off, and then they start working on the second edition, which is even more ambitious.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a 3-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, nah, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores, and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves, and it's super convenient, and it actually, like, we tried to find a catch, and there's not one.
So, to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I have a question. In these days, are these editions alphabetical per volume? Are they covering different source material, different subject matter material? Is this meant to be a compendium of all things? Because in my knowledge of the Encyclopedia Britannica from back in the day was that you had your A's and your B and your C and your D,
et cetera. They did not have that yet. So at this point, it was like, these are things that we think is important. Like people, like, they had like a, I think a 30-page article about smoke,
right?
Like how smoke, it was a lot of things, and it was interesting. Like they had a couple like chapters that were shorter than, they would also have like just random writings that weren't titled that were like longer than chapters and
just
stuff.
Like
it was
an interesting scientific thought, philosophical stuff, the nature of famous works of art. You know, they were aiming to be as comprehensive as possible, but going into it, they knew that they wouldn't be able to include everything. So it was not as comprehensive as later versions. And perhaps that's why they so quickly got to making the second edition. The first one, like we said, 3 volumes. The second one, 10 volumes, 9,000 pages. According to the scuttlebutt, people generally believe the first edition had 2,391 pages. So this is explosive growth.
And surely, despite, you know, there maybe having been some issues with the facts in some of these first volumes, these are highly sought after collectibles. Oh, I could only imagine
they're
worth a pretty penny.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And could you even put a price on owning that that part of history?
That's right.
I'm sure places like Sotheby's do.
They try to do so.
Yeah.
We should do the best of their ability.
We should do a history of auction houses. That'd be great.
That's a really, really good idea. I'm making a mental note of that.
Yeah.
As I'm sure Max is making a physical note of that. That's really cool. No, it is. You always ask, like, how can you put a price on this? Well, somebody can, and it's literally their job. And it's been a historical occupation. But no, the second edition is when the editor, James Tyler, but with 2 T's for no good reason. No good reason there. Let's just throw a second silent T in there just to zhuzh it up a little bit. He joined the family. And the second edition went well beyond the aforementioned scope of simply arts and science. They wanted to take it much larger in scope, which is why Smelly, whose name will never not give me a chuckle, he didn't care for including biographical material. Mm-hmm. So he actually opted out of being the editor because he felt like they were going against his particular philosophy of what these volumes should consist of.
Right, right. Which is largely what we would call STEM knowledge and maybe classical arts. But the idea was, look, I don't want this to be eroded into like meandering Jeremiads about Tamerlane or something. And
I'm sorry, Jeremiads?
Yeah, Jeremiad is a word for a long complaint.
That's incredible. Because like, how are people named Jeremiah supposed to feel about this?
They know what they did.
I guess they do. Yeah.
So it's like a bitter lament. It's a sad story.
I'm adding that to my list of esoteric words to throw around at parties.
Spare me your Jeremiads. And they're saying,
yes, indeed.
I just didn't like the live action Death Note. And you're like, I said, good day.
Oh, the live action Death Note was quite bad.
I enjoyed it.
You did?
I enjoyed parts of it. Yeah.
I enjoyed parts of it, I suppose. But overall, it just seemed a little flabby. And see, mine was the opposite of a Jeremiah, which was a very pithy complaint. The live action Death Note was quite bad. Moving on.
Yeah. So moving on, James Tyler, whose name may not be a typo. We're not quite sure because, again, California.
That's typo with 2 T's, but.
Yeah, T-T-Y-L-E-R. We are, T-T-Y-L. ER. He's a talk to
you
later.
No, I want to stay. Let's keep going. We don't have to part ways quite yet.
He's a talk to you later. This name may have been a typo. I mean, these are the same people who not too long ago at this point spelled California with 2 L's, but
as Anthony Kiedis intended.
Right. He doesn't get the best description from the Britannic itself and from the from contemporaries, like the Scottish poet Robert Burns, most famous for Burns Day, the time when the world and nerds eat haggis. Robert Burns described him as an obscure, tippling, but extraordinary body. And Britannica themselves says this James Tyler guy was a brilliant but penniless polymath. Like, hey, man, why are you so good at numbers, but you're so broke?
I mean, you know, I did really well on the verbal part of the SAT and not so well on the math.
So they also, in Britannica, they note that James Tyler was outlawed for printing a seditious handbill. And he died in Salem, Massachusetts because of his zine. He did a zine.
But they didn't suspect him of witchcraft or anything, did they? Salem, Massachusetts is just a coincidence.
Just sedition.
Okay, fair enough. Just addition. So onward into expanding this volume, this ragtag crew went, releasing the third edition between 1788 and 1797, upping the number of editions to 18 and 14,579 pages. We're quickly approaching what some might call a ponderous tome.
I do like a ponderous tome. Yeah, this is getting unwieldy, right? This edition is edited by Mefaquar, but he passes away in 1793, and they have another guy, a clergyman named George Gleig, take over the work. The third edition does something that is enormous for Britannica. They give recognition to the authors who are writing a lot of this. They used to just print a list of publications, right? Like, we got this from, you know, our version of Town and Country. But the third edition has a preface where it names the chief contributors. This means that you can see the authors of these things. And you also, because copyright law is very different back then, they also still just reprinted stuff that they got from other books. So there was a bit of cut and paste.
No citation?
I think they did cite the books.
Okay, cool. Fair news.
Like, this is a description of auras from Twilight or whatever.
Gotcha. This is a reprinting of the lyrics to Amber by the seminal 90s rap rock band 311.
Right. And at this point, Britannica notes that things are taking off. They sold 10,000 copies of the third edition, and the profit for the original two creators, Bell and McFarquhar, was £42,000. If we want to inflation calculate that, we do have the number.
And
a boop.
Boop, boop, boop.
5,605,999.62 today.
With a very large margin of error, because going modern day to this period of time and changing from pounds to dollars, not great.
It was a lot of money is what we're saying. These kids were basically set for life.
Set for life. I was about to say, that's borderline retirement money, I would say, depending on your what kind of lifestyle you choose to live.
That's like for reasonable people, surely.
I think so.
That's
I
like would think retirement,
so.
Right?
I think it would be, yes, correct. This is so hard to say these days with the price of eggs going through the
price
roof.
Of caviar spoons alone.
Indeed. The 19th century was, of course, a time of great growth and expansion throughout the world, you know, in terms of, science and technology and just an exponential movement of ideas and things. Therefore, the encyclopedia had to keep up. A big change was with a growing collection of archive writings that were becoming more readily available. Therefore, it took a lot less time to dig all this stuff up, right? And to write new things, new kind of hot takes.
Yeah, because let's keep in mind, in these early days, we're still in the early days, these guys weren't, you know, Googling stuff. They had to go find books, and these books were not in infinite quantities. So you might have to just go find the one library that has the one manuscript that you need, because it's the best explanation of, you know, gravity or smoke. Right. So this is what they were working with. We want to be very clear. They were doing hard, arduous research. And, we don't want to get too far in the weeds, but they get the fifth edition in 1815. It's a revision of the fourth edition. They started doing this thing where they would publish corrections in the final volume of a collection when they were still doing it like on weekly disbursements. Then they did the, sixth edition, then they did the fifth edition, then they did the, you know, it goes to the eighth, the ninth, 10th, 12th, 13th. By this time, we're in the early 20th century. And unbeknownst to many, many people, except possibly some international banking interest, Britannica and every business in the West was about to be in big, big trouble.
Yeah, it was inevitable. We were going to get there. At the beginning of the 1930s, Britannica, much like everybody else on the planet, fell a victim to the Great Depression.
We can't afford candy. How are we going to buy this encyclopedia set?
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes you realize how much it's how easy it is to take for granted the time to access and ingest knowledge and to study. It's not necessarily a survival pastime. If there are, I don't think any survival things would qualify as pastimes. Those are things that are meant to pass the time. Survival stuff is you know, food, shelter, water, protection from marauding bands of roving cannibals.
Or which hobos.
Is totally a thing. Yeah, 1,000,000%. So not to mention that to own a book, you know, let alone a massive volume or series of volumes of this kind of stuff was a very privileged thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, even if you are a huge diehard fan of knowledge and reading and learning, when it comes down to being able to either buy food or water versus buying a book, most people, worst come to worst, are going to have to buy the food or water. It's an excellent point. The publisher at the time resigns in 1932. The vice president of Sears, a guy named Elkin Harrison Powell, check out our Sears episode, is chosen to replace him, even though he has no publishing experience. And Powell brings something new to the game. He says, we're going to do direct sales.
Yes.
Direct sales, door-to-door, door-to-door encyclopedia salesman. I got to tell you, I am so happy you guys didn't see a lot of my onstage sketch comedy. One of the dumbest sketches I ever wrote was door-to-door door salesman. So yeah. It's a guy who goes door-to-door selling doors.
Well, you know, I mean, you could make a case for a door being in disrepair, perhaps, you know, and say, boy, do I have a solution for you. It might be good if he added doors and door accessories, though.
It goes so far off the rails. He also sells doors themed doors like Jim Morrison. So he's a door-to-door salesman.
I think that's fun. I have to say, though, you know, we really do think of this as kind of the golden age of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Simply by virtue of the fact that most people, even if they don't really remember this time, which we don't directly, it became, I think, more mail order or, you know, like a phone number over a blue screen on TV, maybe when we were younger.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea of the traveling salesman, you know, or the vacuum cleaner salesman who would do a demo for you, or, you know, the encyclopedia salesman, it's such a golden kind of image of like Americana, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult to overstate just how common door-to-door sales were, you know, and some of these things continue today, but I think it's safe to say in many parts of the United States, an unannounced visitor at your front door, especially a stranger, is not welcome. Even
not
people
great.
You know, I would assume that, I think we would all assume something was up if one of us just showed up at the other one's house unannounced, because we can text each other. We could do a phone call.
Even if I get a phone call, I'm concerned. I assume someone has died.
Right.
If I get a phone call.
If you showed up at I have you guys back, but if either of you showed up at my house unannounced, I would be like, get the fuck in, turn off your phone. Are the cops involved yet?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Where do we need to, where's the body?
Where are we going? I'm pulling up the Delta app now. Are we just going off the grid?
Exactly. But it makes sense though that the Sears guy sort of spearheaded this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Sears also was famous for their catalog and kind of creating this image of exactly what I was just describing, that kind of American dream sort of bliss. You know, they had like a whole house kit that you could buy and build and assemble yourself.
I would say there's also another great contribution that Powell makes to the Britannica. He says, look, we are going to engage in continual revision. So instead of completely resetting editions at long intervals, they're going to print a new version of the encyclopedia every year. And with each printing, they're going to assume that some percentage of material is going to need to be updated, or they're going to need to add a new, suddenly relevant piece of content. And everything else is just going to be reviewed annually until it's time to revise it, like new countries or something.
So were people, I mean, I guess maybe if you were wealthy enough, you could afford it. Were people like buying entirely new sets every year?
I don't think so.
It couldn't have been.
I mean, they might have been buying new additions.
Yeah.
But even then, like, you know, yeah.
Like institutions are buying this and people are going to those libraries.
That's a good point. They had to have a lot of business from those kinds of institutions. You're absolutely right. But I just got to wonder, like, what's the business model here? It seems like the kind of thing where you sell it once and then it's sort of like we're not going to buy another set of encyclopedias.
Ah, this is where they get to something. What a great setup. This is where they get to something even cooler. So now they have created some new problems trying to fix the existing problems. So now they need a full-time permanent staff of professional editors instead of people who are, you know, like three beers in and say, yeah, man, I'll do it. I'll write about Croatia.
Right. Like the early days. Sure. Yeah.
So they started, they hit the same. So they've got to hire these guys full-time, these people full-time. And then they reach this other problem that I think you've outlined quite well, which is we know that folks don't have a ton of disposable income to just always spend on encyclopedias. So we have to stay relevant, right? And that's where they come up with a group of unsung heroes, the Answer Girls.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Well, it didn't age perfectly, but they were this crack team of women who would, if you owned Encyclopedia Britannica, you could reach out to the Answer Girls. They would research and answer any question you might have. So you could send them a postcard, attach a stamp, and mail it to them, and they would type a detailed report of up to 10,000 words.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to balk at that. For some reason, in my mind, I was picturing them as being like dressed as like Vegas showgirls or something and just had being sort of like a problem. Look, women with knowledge. What a novel idea. And they're lookers, too. You know, so my mistake. That's actually pretty interesting. So this came essentially with your, I guess it wasn't a subscription per se, but you had access to this without having to pay like a per use fee or something.
Yeah, yeah. You had to pay for the stamp, but I thought that was a really cool answer, you know, to the Answer Girls are a great answer to that question. And these changes also are reflected in the 14th edition. This one differs because it is constructed differently in terms of its structure, and it has a different scope. This means there are a lot more editors, 50 associate editors in London and New York, all told. They kind of have an area of expertise on specific subjects, and then they have staffs and offices that coordinate everything to keep people from writing, you know, the same article twice or something like that. And they are not able to really remake the encyclopedia until everybody gets through first the Great Depression and then World War II. So it's like after the 1950s that they say, let's try to zhuzh it back up.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Well, that's right. It wasn't until the mid-1950s, you're right, that this sustained effort to kind of reinvent the wheel here began. And it happened to coincide with Encyclopedia Britannica's 200th birthday in 1968, which was when this task had kind of been completed. The encyclopedia had a lot less old material in it probably than ever before in its entire history. Fast forward to the 1980s, with the advent of a lot more access to digital editions of things.
Yeah.
Technology obviously had improved significantly. The internet was very much the twinkle of it had begun, right? If not the actual World Wide Web, we wouldn't really see reach the public until the 90s. The 1980s did see the development and spread of the PC and disk technology, which was, of course, you guys probably remember this, definitely a precursor to the internet, where you could get things that were, a lot of information that was crammed onto a single disk or a set of disks that would take up way less space than a massive series of books, of bound books. So while it wasn't access to everything with just the click of a mouse, it was a pretty significant step forward.
Oh, no kidding. I remember I had a couple of editions of these growing up. There was the two-disc CD that had illustrations and photos, so kind of just a digitized version of the original thing, but a little bit easier to search. But then the next edition a few years later had video and animation and even audio clips, which was a big deal back in 1997. Oh, man, I sound so old. And at first, they were charging like the same price for these CD sets that they would charge for the physical copies. But overall, the price plummets across time. And sometime in like the, I guess, late 1990s or so, Britannica releases their website, eb.com. It's a subscription service where you can digitally use the encyclopedia. Who signs up for online subscriptions? You might be asking yourself, because they're not as common today outside of like streaming platforms, right?
Yeah. I guess that's funny you said that out loud, and I was like, well, I've got a bunch, but they are largely video or music streaming services. I don't necessarily subscribe to any database, but you can subscribe to like LexisNexis,
yeah,
and things like that. But don't you also have to be from a representative of an institution or
not
have some bona fides?
Like, okay, like we could get into
newspapers.
Newspapers. Really, yeah, but man, people balk at those. Oh, dude, they really do. And I've certainly signed up for a few here and there because we use them all the time. But it's only human to try to get as many free articles as you can before they block you out behind that paywall and then it resets. So, I do wonder about that.
I always wanted, in my family, there were a couple of sets of OED, but as well the Encyclopedia Britannica. And the thing is, they're just so, they're prestigious and it's beautiful and it is a fount of knowledge, but they're so cumbersome, man.
Yeah.
It's a lot to move around. Like the main reason I hesitate to move, you've been to my house before. I have a lot of books, dude. And it's like, it's always a culling period when it's time to move. So maybe the CD is the less sexy, but for the time, more efficient answer.
Well, it's interesting too, because I don't have nearly as many books as you do. I have some, but I have quite a lot of
instruments.
Of LPs and instruments. But I have, I guess my comparison here is with, you know, I subscribe to different streaming services, but I also buy a lot of physical albums.
Yeah.
And that's because those are the ones that I want. If the internet explodes, if the streaming services go bust, also the ones that I want those artists to actually get decently paid for, because we all know that artists and surely writers aren't getting nearly as much money for streamed or digitally accessed content. So, but I also, you know, I like having the physical copy of an album that I really want to listen to from front to back and have the full color art and all that stuff. And I think that applies to physical books as well.
Agreed. You know, and also I'm still paranoid from one of the very first books that was issued through, I think, Kindle or something. It was 1984. People purchased it. And then due to a rights disagreement, it was pulled from their Kindles. So I don't feel like you really own something unless you have the tangible artifact of it.
Oh, we know that to be true. Like, for example, I think it was with PlayStation. There was something with PlayStation Network where if you bought I think it was to do with the Warner Brother acquisition, you know, by Discovery, that if you had quote unquote bought some of these HBO shows or whatever it was, some HBO content or something involved in the merger, they changed the nature of those rights and the way that stuff worked. And you really didn't own that stuff at all. And a lot of that stuff just vanished. And it was like, well, we've got your money and you didn't read the fine print. So I completely agree with you. I don't believe that I own anything unless I have it in physical form.
Yeah. Possession, 9/10. So we know that Britannica is still around today. It had a lot of recent news as we get closer to the modern times. In 1996, Britannica is sold to a financier named Jacob E. Safra, and he really leads a restructuring of Britannica overall as a company, as an institution, as an enterprise. The sales of the print encyclopedia naturally are declining. The sales force, the door-to-door encyclopedians, they get disbanded. In 1999, they launch a different site, Britannica.com. It is free. It also has subject channels, current events.
That's the one we use largely. If we're citing it, we're citing something that we've found there, right?
Right. The truth of the matter is the two things eventually, like they basically did the fusion dance and became one.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And they also... It was so popular when it came out that several times it crashed because too many people were too curious.
You know, I'm not going to lie. I mean, curiosity is such an important facet of being a human, and it is also literally our bread and butter. So I hope people never stop being curious, because it is kind of what pays our bills and gives us a reason to get up in the morning, because we don't do this stuff just for money. I mean, we're genuinely curious people, which is, I think, what has allowed us to do okay in this field.
Our group texts are so weird, you guys. I think they're interesting.
you guys never commented on my new game purchase, by the way.
What was it? Morrowind?
Morrowind, which I made sure to get off of the streaming source that I bought it from and onto my PC because of your point earlier.
Yeah.
That was my PC, my Mac.
Was that pre-Elder Scrolls or post?
It's Elder Scrolls 3.
It's in the franchise, and it's back when they were, oh man, I enjoy that one, but I kind of hate enjoy it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to when, like, I'm moving up. Daggerfall I had to put down because it's just so old and it's really just brutally boring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of looking forward to Oblivion. They have D&D dice rolls on your attacks in Morrowind. I found a mod that turned that off, and I'm like, thank God. Basically, Noel, if you swing at somebody, there's a chance you hit, even if you're swinging right at them.
They're like, maybe you hit. which That's is how funny. D&D works.
And the same thing for them.
I do kind of like that turn-based combat, like, you know, that's...
But it's not turn-based.
It's not even turn-based.
No, it's okay. Just, it's rolling the dice, and then, so you could end up whiffing several times, no matter what your skill level is.
I don't know, that sounds a little infuriating.
And you get killed by a mud crab.
Baldur's Gate 3, let me just proselytize.
That's what I've heard,
that.
I was about to ask. Amazing. Yeah, that seems so right up fun. Max's alley.
Too much, it's too much fun.
I'm still back in Skyrim land. I've awesome. Been away for a while. I haven't had access to it, but I'm looking forward to jumping back in and watching the new Fallout series, which I think kicks butt.
It was amazing. Watching
really making me want to just play Fallout New Vegas. I was also just out in Vegas, so it'd be fun to see. I stopped by Prim on the way to Joshua Tree. Some of those cities are real, and like the roadside dinosaurs and stuff. But the first one that really reinvigorated that was just, what, Fallout 3?
Yeah.
Three. Yeah, that was the one. The two was still kind of top down.
Three is one Bethesda bought it after two.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And they changed it around.
So that's when it really starts being the one we know and love. Yeah.
Yeah. They used a lot of the stuff they had built out for Morrowind.
It's like the Encyclopedia Britannica. A lot of iterations. Yeah,
sure it is. Sure. Why not?
Why not?
Wouldn't it be?
Why is any... We will not allow anything to be beyond compare. We're kidding, though.
Really quickly, though, we talked about how valuable a physical copy of the first edition might be. And let's see if we could find one. First edition Encyclopedia Britannica. While I'm Googling that, though, whether or not you can put your hands on one or you have one and it's worth a bundle, you can access it online and see how it's aged.
And Noel, to correct myself from earlier, yeah, it's A through Z.
It is, but it's an incomplete A through Z in the very first thing. Like they alphabetize their entries, but they know they're not getting to everything, right? So there are countries they know exist that they don't include in there, things like that in the first edition.
Oh, fine.
And you can see this for real. You can read the first edition free digitally.
Exactly. I do want to just drop this in the chat, guys, real quick, just so you can take a look. Because we remember how we talked about it was almost like a comic book for super nerds, because comic books are already for nerds. Look at the way these are put together. They're in these boxes like a freaking graphic novel compendium that you might buy. And each of these individual volumes is about the size of a graphic novel. And here on abebooks.com,
I love Abe
you can
books.
Get a first edition, let's see, two slightly incomplete sets bound in 107 volumes for $3,500.
Which is honestly lower than I thought it would be.
It's way lower than I thought, but I just wanted to give a frame of reference. I imagine that a complete set would be maybe not exponentially, but probably quite a bit more valuable.
Look at the way they wrote it, though. Two relatively incomplete sets. So are they saying that there's a Venn diagram of missing books? Because it's two sets. Are they both missing the same books?
Yeah.
Who has stolen volume 7? What kind
some
of
are thicker than others too. Oh, yeah, like they're not all of uniform length. Like they're kind of all over the place. And I'm sorry, I look as I'm zooming in, I'm realizing these are just in kind of like those office move boxes. Right. Those kind of crazy. These are not bound and sold
these
in
are
this
not
fashion.
Slip cases.
But it's still pretty cool, man. Like some of these are really thin. Like what was in this one over here on the far right? It looks like it's literally like a single article, like bound. It's really interesting.
It's that's the one about farts.
Yeah,
flatulence, which, you know, naturally they
written solely by Smelly.
Yeah, they expand. There we go. Max, they expand that volume can. Over time. This is a great way to end our exploration today, folks. We have a great Ridiculous Historian Award to give to our friend AJ Bahamas Jacobs, who has reputedly read the Encyclopedia Britannica in its entirety. And I remember talking with him about this.
Pretty sure he's also read the Bible in its entirety, at the very least the Old Testament.
Constitution as well.
And oh, come on. That's like the least impressive of the three things we just
did. No. It's true. We're actually probably going to see him relatively soon. So we need to quiz him a little bit about which edition are we talking here. And what were your impressions overall?
I feel like I talked with him about that at some point. And he's such a humble guy, folks. We can't say enough good stuff about Bahamas. So check out his show, The Puzzler. He's got a book coming out that we'll have him back on to talk about it. But
definitely.
He's got a new
book.
It's in
the works, actually.
Yeah, The Year of Living Constitutionally. Also check out
I think we're going to have him on for a sort of constitutionally themed episode.
Oh, he knows so much weird stuff now.
It's so cool. I really like that guy.
And he, I got into him because of The Year of Living Biblically, which absolutely slaps as well. But yes, big, big thanks to Mr. AJ Bahamas Jacobs. Big, big thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister.
Hey, I like Jonathan Strickland, too. We give him a lot of crap. We sort of couched him as this sort of villain in our universe. But we like spending time with Jonathan, too. I don't want his feelings hurt thinking that he's been replaced by a shinier, newer puzzle-related person.
Peek behind the curtain. That's very nice, and I'm glad. I think it's an important point for us to make. But peek behind the curtain, it was Jonathan's idea to be the bad guy for the show.
And he wanted to be a heel.
Always been that. And that's the phrase he used. So he is our number one heel. We don't need Achilles heel. We got Quister heel.
Huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this theme, Christopher Asiotis and Yves Jeffcoats here in spirit. Max, I'll thank you again. Ben already did. Sorry, we blast through so many of these. I can't recall. You're awesome, and this is a great episode. Thank you so much for the crack research. And Ben, thanks to you as well. I'm glad to be back, by the way.
I'm glad this didn't turn into a Jeremiad against encyclopedias.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.